This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutin, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena, the better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat can't make it this week, but we are joined by novelist and lecturer, academic Sabah Karim. Welcome, Sabah.
Thank you, Fuad.
And today we're going to talk about the famous distinction made by German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche between the Apollinean and the Dionysian. One that's close to my heart. I was an avid reader of Nietzsche for some time. I'm looking forward to discussing this with you. But first, let's introduce you to the listeners. Now, you wear many hats. You do many things. What's the connection between them, between your academic work, your novel writing, and your love for Nietzsche? Let's start with that.
I think it's all connected, and I don't like to create any segregations between what I do. And I think the whole idea of wearing so many hats is to connect everything. Because I think we live in a world of great competition, competition for knowledge, competition in terms of like succeeding. And I think there is a lot of pressure on all of us to do very well. And I feel that without an academic background, it's very difficult to be as deep and as thorough as I feel many philosophers and authors are today. And I think the whole point of doing, for example, a PhD at this point in time is to be able to use the depth that I have gained or that I would have gained and translate it into the different spheres of my life. And so I definitely think everything's connected. And even when I read Nietzsche, for example, I see a connection with my PhD thesis, which I'm working on, which is on war, which is on obviously human nature, on psychology, on the way people behave, on evil and all of these topics which Nietzsche talks about. So everything's connected.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, today Nietzsche isn't really engaged with in the social sciences or even the contemporary mainstream humanities, right? You find him in philosophy, maybe Germanic studies, literature and some departments, but he's no longer as mainstream as I think he should be. But I do the same thing. I'm using a Lacanian framework for the most part, psychoanalytic framework, and he's just always lurking, you know. And I think that's enough for me because I think he's a good interlocutor to have as I do even more contemporary stuff. So before we go into details about the ideas, I want to profile you a bit more. Maybe you can just share with us a little bit about your background. You are based in KL. But by the way you talk and maybe your name is not very commonly Malaysian. So what's the story behind that? How did you end up here and how's it been so far?
I am from Mauritius and I came to KL in 2001 to do a law degree over here. And then I went back to Mauritius and I traveled a bit. I went to different countries. And then I eventually decided to come back to KL. I stayed here for a while, went back to other places again, and just kept doing that for a while until I decided that I would just make this my home. So I've been here for, 15 years now. And, all in all for 15 years. And I am I use this as a base to travel. And since I'm doing my PhD on Cambodia, I travel there very often. This is a very strategic place to travel from.
Is KL basically where you've been most productive? Is that where you've been writing mostly?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. I think it's very difficult to pen people into different categories. Like in Mauritius, I am considered to be, my books are put in the local author section. For a while, they were in the international section. I was not very happy about that. And over here, I'm in the local author section. In the bookstores because, I heard because of the ISBN. It has nothing to do with my nationality, apparently. But my stories are primarily Mauritian. And I think to say that, let's say, my stories are based on all Mauritian characters is a big mistake. Because a lot of what I've observed about human nature is actually what I've experienced in Malaysia because this is where I've stayed for most of my life. The second half of my life right now. And I think, therefore, there is definitely an influence of Malaysia on my work, although it's not overtly mentioned in my novels.
Sure. That's fascinating, too, because you are representing these intersections of perspectives, cultures, if you will, and now Cambodia is on the list as well. It'll be interesting to see how this turns out. Now, why have you chosen the Apollinean and Dionysian distinction to discuss today?
because it has a very big impact on my life as an author, as a student, as an academic. Why? Because when I started thinking about issues of existentialism, I definitely encountered this dichotomy between the philosopher and the artist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think this dichotomy is what I found in Apollo and Dionysus, mm-hmm. Which is obviously Nietzschean, mm-hmm. the way in which he fuses the two to mm-hmm. show the differences that exist. Because if, as a reader of philosophy, I found many works very tedious, too systematic, too detailed, too taxing, and taxing because although they were deep, they were not in contact with reality.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that there was this disconnection with what I felt was instinctively true.
Mm-hmm.
So I could follow, for example, the person's thought process. I'm taking Kant as an example.
Mm-hmm.
But there comes a point where you feel very disconnected from him because you are led into certain realms of the theory, of the theoretical,
mm-hmm.
and you feel that it is completely detached from reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think if we have to use this in the perspective of, we have to use this in the optic of Apollo and Dionysus, what we find is this concentration on Apollo,
mm-hmm.
where you feel, where this is exactly the criticism of Nietzsche, where mm-hmm. Nietzsche said that we have been focusing too much on the Apollonian side.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that Greek civilization was at its lowest when the philosophers, such as Socrates,
yeah.
among others, became very dialectical.
Mm-hmm.
In the manner in which they would present philosophy. So
mm-hmm.
which means that they would become, they would engage in debate, they would quibble, they would use reason, they would get carried away with the whole process of, arranging thoughts and turning everything into a very rigid system,
mm-hmm.
which would be very divorced from the realities of life. And
mm-hmm.
I think that is where I found these forces, these dynamics,
mm-hmm.
which I encountered as a person who's writing, as a person who's thinking, as a person who's working on a thesis.
It's interesting that you contrasted Kant with Nietzsche in that sense, because Kant basically concludes that we are detached from reality, what we get are merely appearances, but there is nonetheless a certain systematic rationality you can salvage, and with that you can build an ethical system, but by that time life is out of the picture, right? So what Nietzsche brings into this equation is that there is this other side, the Dionysian, that speaks to us in a more instinctive, pre-rational way, and that this is somehow truer to what life is about. But let's start with specific definitions now. Who's Apollo? Who's Dionysius? And how are they juxtaposed with one another?
I think at a very simple level, Apollo and Dionysius were never linked at the time that Nietzsche wrote. Nietzsche on purpose brought these two gods. These two gods are gods of Greek mythology. He purposely brought these two gods together and showed the sort of relationship that can exist between them. Now, Apollo and Dionysus, they are both gods of art.
Mm-hmm.
Apollo is the god of reason, of rationality, of coherence, of logos, of calm, of the thoughtful nature that you find in man.
Mm-hmm.
Dionysus, on the other hand, is the god of revelry, the god of wine,
mm-hmm.
the god of mayhem, the god of chaos, the god of instinctive drive towards everything that is supposedly base
mm-hmm.
in the Judeo-Christian definition of it. And so what Nietzsche did was that he brought these two gods together in his book, The Birth of Tragedy, which he wrote in 1876.
His first major work, in fact.
His first major work. He brought these two gods together to show the sort of fusion that should exist if you were to produce the best work of art.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he talks about is that for a long time, there was a Dionysian fever that had spread between Rome and Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
And he spoke about how it was the Greek era that came in, the Greek civilization that came in, and tried to capture that energy that was rampant in the world and combine it with the Apollonian part of Greek civilization to produce the best form of art.
Mm.
There is a very big debate between Aristotle and Nietzsche between who produced the best form of art. Aristotle starts with Euripides as the best, and then he says Sophocles is in the middle, and he ends with Achilles. Whereas Nietzsche reverses this order and actually says that Achilles is the best, Sophocles is in the middle, and Euripides is the worst. Mm-hmm. In fact, he says Euripides led to the suicide of
tragedy.
Of tragedy.
Yeah.
Why? Now, let's look at all of this. Euripides, according to Nietzsche, Euripides increased the number of characters in his plays, and at the same time, not only did he do that, but he also started to solve problems mm-hmm. by using the method of debate, mm-hmm. reasoning, which is exactly what Socrates does. Mm-hmm. And so he felt that this method of solving the big problems of life, that is through debate, through logic, mm-hmm. through reasoning, was a very limited, and I would even say decadent, although he doesn't use the word there,
right.
but a very decadent way of solving problems. Mm-hmm. And this, the way in which he reverses what Aristotle believes, is very important to understand where he was coming from mm-hmm. in terms of what he thinks of Dionysus. And I think many people feel that Dionysus was probably the most preferred god for Nietzsche.
One of his final major letters, towards the end of his life, he signed himself off as Dionysius.
Yes, that's right. The
couple of things that I take from your account there. The first is that Nietzsche is unique because, contrary to most mainstream renditions of the history of Western thought, Greek philosophy is seen as some kind of pinnacle. Whereas for Nietzsche, Socrates marked a decline because Socrates inaugurated a different discourse about life, in introducing rationality, systematic thought, trying to justify why we are here, whereas taking a tragic route would not lead us to be beholden to that question. The question would not be answered systematically, but lived. And that's what Nietzsche wants to, in many ways, salvage in his account of the Greeks, that it is the pre-Socratics that drew him more than Socrates onwards. The other thing as well that we can take from here before we pause for the second part of the show is that these two categories are artistic principles, right? So they're two different ways of relating to life as a craft, either in accentuating our more rational aspects or the more instinctive, one would say, base, quote-unquote, dimensions to who we are. These are represented by two different ways of expressing ourselves. So the Apollinean marks crafts such as sculpture, painting, the more visual aspect of art, whereas Dionysian is typically associated with dance, for example, one that summons the body to express itself without being tied to the meaning of words necessarily, but grounded in these spaces. So there's a lot here. So we had a really masterful summary from Sabah, but we'll be back for the second part of the show. You're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahman, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahman, and this week we're joined by Sabah Karim, novelist, academic, and also lecturer. And we are discussing the Apollo and Dionysius distinction made famous by German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. And in the first part of the show, we basically defined the terms and also highlighted their relationship with one another. And in the second part of the show, we're probably going to discuss their implications and how we can better understand this in a practical way to put it into use, because that would be the Dionysian thing, to live it rather than to just think it. But let's start with a basic question here. These two distinctions were most highlighted in his first major work, like you said, The Birth of Tragedy. Now that title is peculiar. What's the relationship between these concepts with tragedy? What does Nietzsche have in mind when he says tragedy?
Let us take the play of the play by Sophocles, Oedipus, mm-hmm. To illustrate what we mean by the tragic. Now, at a simple level, the tragic just means, you know, something very, something unfortunate. Mm-hmm. But at a deeper level, the tragic is has a lot to do, well, there are different definitions by Aristotle, by Nietzsche, and by whoever else used the story. Because, by the way, Oedipus comes in, has been written by, the story of Oedipus has been written by different poets. Mm-hmm. Now, the story of Oedipus is about King Laius and Queen Jocasta, who had a son, but it was predicted, it was told to King Laius that when his son would be born, he would one day, if he had a son rather, his son would one day kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And so to thwart this prophecy, King Laius took his son and left him on the mountainside. And there he was picked up, to die rather. But what happened was he was picked up, the baby was picked up by two characters. Now, he was brought up by them, and then he left them when he was an adult. He left and he went to Thebes.
Yep.
And when he went to Thebes, he encountered an old man on the way, yeah. And this turned out to be his father. So he killed his father, not knowing, of course, that it was his father.
There was an altercation.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, then he realized that he had to face the challenge that was put forward by the Sphinx. There was a riddle that he had to answer. And when he answered that correctly, he was given the chance to become the king
mm-hmm.
of Thebes, and he was made to marry his own mother. Of course, mm-hmm. he didn't know that at the time. Much later in time, when there was a plague and all of that, he found out that it was that he had married his mother. And mm-hmm. immediately his mother hanged herself, and he took two pins from her dress
mm-hmm.
and basically
blinded himself. Yeah.
And this, we can say, is the essence of the tragic. Because what Aristotle says when he explains what he means by the tragic is that he says that the tragic, this event, which is the misfortune of the tragic hero, should happen not because of the hero's lack of virtue or because of an issue that is related to vice, in other mm-hmm. words, but it should happen because the hero was led into this because of certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
So here, this is where we bring in this issue of fate, F-A-T-E.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have to remember is that the tragic hero undergoes these series of misfortunes, not because of his vice, but because of an error of judgment mm-hmm. somewhere.
And the interesting thing is that Oedipus is a king. The title of the play points to that. And that shows, too, that there's only so much that whatever power or control we can claim can guarantee about how life will turn out. And what we find in Oedipus is that he was banished, picked up by a different family, and then he would search for the meaning of the prophecy, only to end up to where, like you said, he was fated to be. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, this is a reflection of what we grapple with. We make these choices thinking that we're in control, that we can kind of predict their outcomes, and we have a certain desired end result in mind as fantasies that move us. But ultimately, we're still bound by circumstances, by these actual concrete impediments that
right.
confine us. So, yes, Oedipus was a king, but in many ways, his flaws were very human.
And I think we have to make a distinction here between the way in which these plays were portrayed and the way in which the later plays came about, where mm-hmm. they were affected, or rather, they were influenced by mm-hmm. a more Judeo-Christian
mm-hmm.
Morality, where in those other plays we see characters just, for example, doing bad, doing evil, mm-hmm. and then suffering as a consequence. Whereas these plays go to the bigger, they touch on the bigger questions of life to you.
Yeah, and Sophocles, it was, from what I recall, it was largely a flashback, right? So Oedipus was figuring out why there was the plague, and he would kind of trace his life trying to piece the different clues together before kind of seeing the revelation.
Yeah.
So that's interesting that we sketch famous play, tying it up to what Nietzsche is trying to do. How does Apollo and Dionysius come into this?
Basically, if you look at the way in which the play is structured, we talk about the manners of ruling the country. We talk about Oedipus as a leader, whether he's a just or unjust. There are criticisms about him as a leader. So here we are talking about, let's say, the Apollonian side of the play. But at the same time, the Dionysian side of the play is, for me, where you realize that you cannot solve all of these problems
mm-hmm.
if you have a very logical way of understanding what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have to let go of all the logic that exists in life, all the reasons that we
yeah.
come up with life to justify the evil around us, and realize there's something that's beyond that. And that is, for me, the instinctive side, the Dionysian side,
mm-hmm.
which comes in.
And you mentioned the contrast that Nietzsche is going to constantly go back to between the Greeks and the Christians. And one of the biggest gulf there is in the Christian tendency to rationalize tragedy, right? To try to give reasons for why things messed up. And there's a certain virtue in that you get contemplation, you get wisdom, but we often overrate its importance. We often overrate its value because, like you say, there are always these gaps.
It's a very good way of, it's a coping mechanism to actually find reasons for what went wrong in life.
Yeah.
But what Sophocles does through his plays is to show that there are many things that we can't explain. And that is why we, in the world of art, in the world of philosophy, we look up to these plays as being superior, because then we touch on the unknown, on that which we cannot control as human beings.
Indeed. And there's something about the Dionysian that really points to this deeper or more obscured connection that we have with the world, that in that when we let go and we let things happen, we become, for lack of a better word, one with it, right? Whereas the contemplative, logical standpoint that Apollo signifies demands that we distance from the world, demands that we step back and we try to map it out as if from the outside, or so to speak.
Yes,
but when we let go of that tendency, we morph into the greater flow and antagonisms that are happening around us.
But I think there is also another lesson which we must point out, that that is taught by this conflict or this dichotomy that exists between Apollo and Dionysus. This is the importance of Apollo, because we've spoken a lot about the virtues of Dionysus. Apollo allows man, and this is where Nietzsche differentiates among human beings. He speaks of superior human beings as being those who know how to mold the character according to Apollonian forces. And it is Apollo, the god of reason, the god of logic, coherence, etc., who allows the Dionysian side to be tamed in a certain way, and he expects the artist par excellence, the real artist, the philosopher, to be able to mold his character, to disguise or to gain mastery over his weaknesses, for example, to know himself better. And there, and then here we go back to what Socrates, you know, what we talked about in the Temple of Delphi, know thyself, which is the basic principle of philosophy. And so this is what Nietzsche emphasized on. In the later part of his life, Nietzsche did not speak of Dionysus as being a different entity to Apollo.
Yes.
For him, Dionysus had undergone a transformation. And this transformation was what he found in the character of Goethe, where he found that Goethe was the emblem of that fusion between Dionysus and Apollo.
And you can see this in Goethe's life. He was, I mean, we know him as a novelist, but he was a statesman as well. He had undergone many misadventures along the way. Just as a side note too, this is a good chance to bring into discussion, although briefly, the Übermensch. Popular conceptions of the Übermensch, popular conceptions of Nietzsche.
Misconceptions.
Yeah, misconceptions, unfortunately. Think of the Übermensch as this fascist character that's hell-bent on power. But Nietzsche just really means a creative genius.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which brings us to the issue of practicality. And we don't often talk about practicality when we talk about philosophy, but I think there's a lot here that's practical.
Yes.
What do you have in mind?
Well, we have to be able to connect. I think it's a rule, otherwise philosophy becomes dry. Philosophy becomes boring, okay? Mm-hmm. We have to be able to connect everything we learn, we read, to what's happening around us. So let us ask this big question. How was this conflict, or the fusion later on, that Nietzsche spoke about in terms of this fusion between Dionysus and Apollo, how was this connected to his life? And I would take the example of Richard Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Richard Wagner, the composer, the artist, the one who was very closely tied to Nietzsche and who was Nietzsche's great friend, you know, in the early part of his life, was actually Nietzsche's great hero. And Nietzsche admired him from afar at first because of his production. And one of his compositions was actually Tristan and Isolde. When he produced Tristan and Isolde, Nietzsche thought that Wagner, Richard Wagner, had managed to be in touch with the creative side that lay in his genius. And he believed and he respected and admired Richard Wagner for that. When he became friends with him, that is when I think he came up with The Birth of Tragedy and mm-hmm. dedicated the book to Richard Wagner and spoke in very high terms about Richard Wagner. But later on, according to Nietzsche, success got to his head. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was Richard Wagner produced Percival. And Percival was considered to be, in Nietzsche's opinion, a very mediocre work mm-hmm. because it incorporated very Christian elements mm-hmm. in the way in which it was presented. And for Nietzsche, this was a sign that Richard Wagner had sold his soul to the devil. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he felt that Nietzsche had let go of the creative side, that pagan side. And I don't mean pagan in a negative sense, mm-hmm. but in a Greek sense mm-hmm. of the word, in high terms. He let go of the pagan side, the wild Dionysian side, to give in to the interests of the state. Because mm-hmm. remember, at the time, the church and the state were closely
right.
allied.
Right.
So he felt that Richard Wagner had sacrificed his creative flair to give in, to pander to the interests of the state. And for Nietzsche, that was a huge disappointment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is admirable, I think, about Nietzsche is that he acted on his principles.
Mm-hmm.
And just because this went against his philosophy, mm-hmm. his belief in the pure creative genius mm-hmm. of Richard Wagner mm-hmm. and the fact that he had sacrificed his soul to the devil, he cut off Richard
Wagner.
Ended
the friendship, yeah.
And ended the friendship and basically never got back to being friends with him, although he was very close to him and his wife, who,
mm-hmm.
well, some of the French documentaries I've watched speak about how Nietzsche had a very big crush on Cosima
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and the wife of Richard Wagner. So he cut off from Richard Wagner because of this. So we can see the application of Apollo and Dionysus in Nietzsche's life. And many people who went to visit Nietzsche at the end of his life, when, you know, they say he was not in a very stable mental state, say that he used to play music mm-hmm. like a wild person.
Mm-hmm.
And one even described him, I think Peter Gast even described Nietzsche as being carried away by this by the Dionysian fever
yeah.
in playing music.
And in life as well, because Nietzsche, for the most part, was, if you look at his physical condition, he was frail. He was suffering from migraines and headaches for the longest time. And these are conditions that you'd think would predispose someone to be more religious, you know, to be more guarded,
yes.
To be more self-preserving. But he nonetheless maintained a certain affinity to fate or nature, the world, and still nonetheless finding a joy of life in it.
That's right.
And I think that's the key thing, because it's so easy to be defeated by life, right? To say that this is
that's
the
right.
end, that I just have to wait for a better world, or to think that there is nothing to take out of our challenges and sufferings. But Nietzsche says, no, there's always something to affirm.
Yes, and I think he dealt with all the ups and downs of life, I would think, and that's why I have a lot of respect for him,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of dignity.
Mm-hmm.
And he never admitted defeat. He always, he had to face, you know, opposition from everywhere. And he knew how to keep his head high.
When I was just starting out philosophy, typically what I would also always start with are biographies, right? And there's some biographies that, even though they're very respectable towards the figure, they can't help but to paint a very, I don't know, unflattering picture of these icons. So, for example, somebody like Heidegger, right? I've read his biography, and he's not somebody I would want to just hang out with or even want to be around near, because he's such an egomaniac, you know.
Yeah.
Or somebody like Jacques Lacan. I love Lacan a lot, you know, as a theorist.
Yeah.
But we look at the stuff he's done in his life, you know, plagiarizing, carelessly experimenting on his patients and mm-hmm. stuff like that. You find that there's a certain disregard for humanity in
yeah.
their pursuit for greatness. I can't quite say the same about Nietzsche, despite the fact that when you see his writings, right, when you read his writings, he comes across very fierce and forthright.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes not carrying the kind of complexity that his philosophy ultimately demands. But if you look at his life, he's been rejected romantically so many times. He was lonely for the most part. He was cared for by his sister, whom he had a very antagonistic relationship with, but who ultimately manipulated his philosophy.
So do you mean that you pity him?
It wouldn't be very Nietzschean to pity him.
Exactly.
But
I'm sure he wouldn't have liked you pitying him and wanting to be around him.
No, but his style of writing, the ferocity of his writing, belies the frail aspects of his life. I just find that very interesting.
It is very interesting. When I read Nietzsche and I read all of his works, I also had this very fierce, impression of him. And I thought, wow, I think I'll get along very well with him. And so when I started describing him in my short stories, where I introduced him at various points, I also depicted him like that. And then one day I came across this book. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called When Nietzsche Wept.
Yes, yes.
By Yalom, right? Mm-hmm. And I was appalled by the way in which he described Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Because Nietzsche sounded like this little softy.
Yes, yes.
Very,
yeah.
This very sort of effeminate character. And I wasn't very happy with that, to be honest. And I even went to watch the movie, which was on YouTube.
Which isn't very good, from what I hear.
Which was worse, actually. And then I realized, because I wanted to know why Yalom had chosen to depict Nietzsche in such a light. And then I went to do research and I found out that apparently Nietzsche had a very amiable personality when he was alive, and is very different from the way in which he projects himself in his writing.
Mm-hmm. This is not to sanctify him too much. Nietzsche had a lot of problems, especially politically.
We're apologizing.
Unfortunately. Yeah, we have to be fair as well.
Yes,
in certain social political outlooks, he had a lot to work with. But in any case, there's a lot to salvage nonetheless. Sawa Karim, thank you very much
for
sharing so much with us today. Now, I guess as a recommendation, we can just recommend The Birth of Tragedy to our listeners. I think it's a very easy read to me. It's not easy in the sense that you understand it completely, but in the sense that, at least the English translations, it can lure you deeper into the text very, very smoothly, I feel.
I would personally recommend his other books. And I would say, Beyond Good and Evil is a good start if one were to be introduced to Nietzsche.
That is true too. And how about your books tied to this discussion? What would you suggest?
Well, I would say that obviously Nietzsche has had a very big influence on my writing.
Yeah.
And he's had an influence both on Humaira and Semi-Apes. And I think for me what's very important is the depiction of characters and the conflict that lies in them. So, for example, I think that there are a lot of terms out there, such as, let me just take the simple example of love and hate.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of our, everyday vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
But what I talk about is that in popular thinking, we do not accept, we have not yet assimilated the existence of conflict. So, for example, we know the word love and we know the word hate, but we don't understand and assimilate the word love-hate.
Mm-hmm.
Can you love-hate a person?
Mm-hmm.
I think this is quite possible. And these forms of dichotomies is what I have tried to introduce in the characters that I have presented in both my books. And this, for me, is very Nietzschean.
Mm-hmm. In any case, thank you for joining us
once again.
And maybe we can have you on board again
another
time. Should you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at bfmnightschool@gmail.com or look us up on Facebook. Just type BFM Night School on the search space. We always love to hear from you. I'm Ahmad Fahd Rahmat alongside Sabah Karim this week. And this is Night School on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.